Spending in state senate races hits unprecedented levels. Plus, a report finds some Vermont candidates are flouting campaign finance laws. And a clash over school construction aid. All that and more ahead on Vermont This Week.
From the Vermont Public Studio in Winooski, this is Vermont This Week. Made possible in part by the Lintelac Foundation and Milne Travel. Here's moderator Mitch Wertlieb.
Hi, I'm Mitch Wertlieb. It's Friday, July 31st. And with us on the panel today, we have Peter Hirschfeld from Vermont Public, Allison Novak from 7 Days, and Colin Flanders also from 7 Days. Thank you all so much for being here. Well, we got a primary coming up. We're about to hit the month of August. So August 11th is Vermont's primary. And with that comes news about unprecedented spending in state senate races. Colin, you wrote a story about this. Kind of remarkable seeing some of these numbers out of our little state of Vermont here. You wrote that several other Senate challengers are on pace to raise amounts that would have been unheard of 10 years ago. Tell us about these numbers we're looking at here.
Yeah, so we took a look at campaign finance disclosures of this past cycle. So we're up through July. The next one is August 1st, and we'll probably see even higher numbers. And what's really standing out is, yeah, money is pouring into these races that I think 20, 30 years ago probably would have been spent maybe 4, 5, 10 would have been a lot in some of these races. But now candidates are saying that they need a sizable piggy bank so that they can really run a formidable campaign, especially when they're challenging an incumbent, which all of these high dollar amounts that we're seeing are challengers from people who are trying to break through into the Senate. And that's historically a really difficult thing to do, especially in a place like Chittenden County, where up until recently, there was one big district, 6 people, incumbents carried a lot of weight, and they still do here in Vermont, as we know. And so these candidates are throwing money at everything they can think of to try to get their message out and get their name out there. And I think anyone who lives in Chittenden County will understand this when they go and check their mailbox. I mean, they are just flooded with these campaign flyers and postcards. And I think the big question is whether it's really going to make much of a difference.
Yeah, that is the big question. And, you know, tis the season, as you say, we are getting flooded with campaign ads and people are getting texted here and there. It's a lot. You have an example of someone running for state Senate, Democrat Nikhil Goyal. And, you know, we're looking at least $138,000, I guess, that he's already spent. That's a lot of money. Tell us a little bit about this particular candidate and why you chose to write about him.
Yeah, so Nikhil Goyal, he's raised $138,000. He hasn't spent all of that money, but he still has a lot of money to spend. And there's some time between now and the primary. I think the question is how much is he going to go through? What was interesting about Nikhil is that this is his first race. He's a younger guy. He's 31, but he's pretty well connected. He was an advisor for Bernie Sanders. But I think that he has been leveraging some of these connections that he has nationally, which is something that we don't always see in these local Senate races. A big chunk of his funding has followed an endorsement from an organization that promotes South Asian candidates. He's the son of Indian immigrants. And so these are people who don't even know him personally, but are supportive of the idea of someone of his identity serving in an elected office. And I think that that's something we're not used to seeing as much in these more local races, where I talked to some former long-term senators in Vermont who said that they used to get by on a couple thousand bucks and go into some strawberry socials. And now Nikhil, to his credit, is running what seems to be a very professional campaign. If you log onto YouTube and try to watch a video, chances are you're going to see one of his ads pop across. And it looks like something you'd see in a national race. It's very well produced. And I think there is a question of whether that kind of campaign plays well on the local level, whether people respond to it or whether they might shy away and wonder, well, why are we turning this into such a professional feeling thing?
Yeah, I want to open this discussion up here, but I do want to mention that one of the things you pointed out was that Goyal himself makes no apologies for this. He says, look, this is what I have to do to get my name out there and be competitive.
And he's not alone. I mean, we talked to a few other people as well. The candidates who are raising this amount of money say that this is what it takes in today's day and age. And there is some truth to it. Printing costs are up. Advertising is up. There isn't as many central newspapers, and so they're spending a lot more money trying to get around and get their name out there. But I think some of the incumbents, it is a bit of a convenient argument to make as an incumbent, where you don't have to spend that much money to get your name out there. But I think there is a bit of tension of how much money do you actually need? How many postcards? How many lawn signs before you really run out of things to do with it?
And does it work?
Well, yeah. I was talking to a former Senate Majority Leader who consulted with some Democratic challengers who wanted to step up to the plate. Her advice to all of them was you need to raise at least $60,000. So I think the writing has been on the wall that it is going to be more expensive to get your name out. These are much bigger districts and House districts. And what's interesting, as you noted in your story, is that there are a lot of incumbents that are facing pretty stiff challenges in some instances that have either chosen not to raise a lot of money or are not able to raise a lot of money. There's a challenger in the Windsor district who's raised almost $60,000 as of July 1st. That's about 10 times as much as the two incumbents in that district combined. And I think for a lot of Senate candidates and senators, they look in the mirror and they see maybe a future governor, right? Hmm. And so I think a lot of this is about building the kind of coalition that you need at the outset of your political career so that you can build a trajectory that might lead to a place where you could succeed on a statewide level. And that, of course, is always going to involve a lot of fundraising.
And on the flip side, I will say that the concern that some of the incumbents are flagging, I think it's twofold. It's one, I think a lot of it is the personal stake they have in this. They're seeing a lot of money get spent to take them out. But there is also a concern that for the next wave of senators, for the next 31-year-old who's thinking, maybe I would like to throw my name in there. And then you look and see, well, the last time that somebody broke through, they spent $100,000 or it took them that much to raise that much. And you think, I don't have friends or know people who have that much money. I think there is a concern that it could dissuade some people from running.
Yeah, you know, the other thing I wonder about, again, is how do we know if spending that much money actually works? Has there been any studies yet? Because there are some people who have spent some money and just the outcome hasn't been there for them.
Yeah, it's a little hard because the two of the bigger spenders in at least Chittenden County over the last 20, 25 years were both moderate to more right-leaning Democrats who don't play as well regardless. I think that it is really, really hard to know. And the candidates themselves will admit a lot of it is just like putting stuff out into the void and then you show up on election day and you find out the results. Without any polling, it's really hard to tell.
How much of this is Citizens United just doing its job? Remember 2010 when campaigns, you know, finance laws became a lot less restrictive? Is that what we're seeing here in Vermont?
Well, I talked to a political science professor from Middlebury who made the point that the concern here isn't as much sort of like the Hollywood version of people getting a big check and then 6 months later they'll go vote in the Senate in a certain way. That's not as much here. What we're really seeing is these are allies of these people throwing money because they support it. So that's what's really interesting to us as journalists and to the public is you look at the campaign disclosure forms, you see who's donating, you get a sense of what type of candidate is this, who are they reaching out to, where is their message resonating? You see a lot of landlords, that tells you one thing. You see a lot of grassroots. $5, $10, $20 bills, that tells you something as well.
Well, to your point, you do see the campaign finance where this is coming, but not always, right, Pete Hirschfeld? Because you found that there's a new report out that's saying that there are some candidates in Vermont that are flouting campaign finance laws. How big a problem is this?
Well, according to the Secretary of State's office, one in five of the more than 400 candidates that are running for office this cycle have not filed the legally required disclosure paperwork with the Secretary of State's office. A lot of this is due to a new law that passed just last year that requires candidates to file an affidavit with the Secretary of State if they've raised or spent less than $500. Previously, you didn't have to file anything. Mm-hmm. And I reached out to a number of incumbent lawmakers who didn't file anything. And they said, well, I didn't raise or spend $500. So the news hasn't reached them yet.
Okay.
Other instances, there are people who still struggle to use the campaign finance system, notwithstanding considerable efforts by the Secretary of State's office to make that as user-friendly as possible. I reached out to the Attorney General's office, which is the entity that's responsible for enforcing campaign finance violations. They generally only launch an investigation when somebody brings an alleged violation to their attention. They say the vast majority of the time that when they do reach out to somebody who's in violation, they're eager to voluntarily come into compliance. But there are instances in which those investigations have led to financial sanctions.
What's the concern here? Why is the Secretary of State's office upset about this to some extent?
Well, I think the underlying thesis here is that when people invest in a candidate, they're hoping to get a return on that investment. And I think they feel like that's especially true when it's a corporate entity that's making a contribution. And they feel like Vermonters deserve transparency so that they know who it is that's investing in these candidates and understand what it is those entities might want in return for those contributions if a candidate gets into office and has to make some decisions related to that particular field.
All right. Appreciate your update on that story, Pete. Allison Novak, I want to move on to a story that you wrote about. It's kind of fascinating because we have been seeing these sort of things happen in the state of Vermont for a while now. A lot of older buildings in the state, including schools. Mm-hmm. And you wrote about in Woodstock, Mountain View Supervisory Union. They want to rebuild their middle, their high school. Voters said, absolutely, $112 million bond passed. Great, they're going to fix the school, right? Not so fast. What happened?
Right. So this school, this is the high school for Mountain Views that's in Woodstock. It serves middle and high school students, actually. 70 years old. So this school is in really bad shape. You know, failing pipes, the boiler just broke, ceiling is sinking in. And so they passed this bond. This has been in the works for about 10 years. They've been trying to get money to build a new school. As we know, the state hasn't chipped in for state aid for school construction in, I think, 16 years. So there's been a moratorium since 2008. They passed a bond in March, there was a contingency in that bond. So it basically said that 25% of the cost of the $112 million bond had to be paid for either by private donations and or state or federal money. And the reason they did this was they had a failed bond a couple years before, and they talked to voters, and voters said, you know, we don't think that, like, our local community should have to bear the brunt of this construction. We want the state to chip in. And I think there were signs that the state was going to kind of restart the school construction program. Act 73, which was passed last year, calls for the restarting of the state aid for school construction fund, although there's not a dedicated source for that money yet.
Okay.
So essentially what happened is Mountain Views has a shovel-ready project. They're ready to get going. And they said, we're going to ask the Agency of Education for kind of preliminary approval so we can start getting permits ready, get the ball rolling. So they've been trying to meet with the Agency of Education for the last, you know, couple months. And the agency, according to Mountain Views, has kind of blown them off. Mm-hmm. And essentially what the Agency of Education says is we have to make rules for this new state aid for school construction process for how schools are going to apply. That's going to take us about 2 years. Mm-hmm. And until then, we can't give any schools approval for building.
That's a little scary because what they're telling these kids who go to Woodstock, right, at this school is that, well, for another 2 years, you're going to have to be in that school. Is it safe for them to be in that school?
I mean, I think that the school officials in Mountain Views would say no. When I talk to them, they're very worried that things are going to get to the point where they're going to have to start putting trailers on the field, the football field, which is actually the site for the new school that they have planned. And essentially, they're throwing a lot of money away by doing all these kind of fixes to the building that they are saying, like, we don't want to be doing this because this building is at the end of its, you know, useful life. We don't want to be throwing millions in to fix the boiler, to do things like that. And we want to get started with this new school. The agency says, you know, you shouldn't have written the contingency into the bond saying that, you know, it had to be reliant on getting aid, outside aid. So they're kind of blaming Mountain Views, and Mountain Views is not very happy with that stance.
And one of the dynamics that's at play here is we're seeing Montpelier try to seize control of local schools from communities, right, in some form or fashion at some scale. And one of the ways they thought they could do that was force school district mergers. That didn't work. Another way they have planned is a foundation formula where the state would decide school budgeting. It's unclear whether that will come to pass or not. State aid for school construction is another key tool they have to sort of have a statewide view on what's happening at the local level. And if they can sort of wield this state money in ways that result in a more unified school construction approach, I think they feel like they can get to a place where they have comprehensive regional high schools, which is one of the things they want. Yeah. They don't want each district willy-nilly making decisions on their own about who's going to have a new school and who's not. They want that to be part of a broader statewide conversation about where strategically should we have these really great schools And holding the purse strings for school construction is one tool they have to do
right.
that.
Right. But now that mergers are voluntary, right? I think what a lot of school districts are saying is, like, we can't wait. We have a failing building right now. We can't wait years until a future state that the Agency of Education might be hoping to achieve. We need to kind of meet the immediate needs of our students now. And I've written in the past about the tension between the Agency of Education and educators in the field. And mm-hmm. I think this school construction issue is a good example of how, you know, school districts are feeling like the state and the Agency of Education doesn't really have their back. They have not contributed to school construction in 16 years. And schools, you know, are failing. And they want to feel like the Agency of Education is working to help them, not kind of working against them or blaming them for having an old school. So,
I do have a clarification question here, mm-hmm. Allison Novak, because you were saying that the AOE was saying that this contingency that the Woodstock folks built in, is that the crux of the problem? If they had not built in that contingency, would they be able to get this school built right away?
I mean, I think that's unclear. I think, you know, there's no other kind of school project right now that's ready to go like Woodstock. So I think it's unclear how the agency would kind of approach another project that was ready to go. But I do think what the agency is saying is, like, this is kind of the mistake you made, that you wrote this contingency into your bond. And they're basically saying it's unlawful for us to, you know, sign off on your project when we still have rules to make. The legislature has directed us to make these rules, and we have until March 2028 to make the rules. And so they're saying, like, we can't help you right now.
Wow.
Yeah. Longview doesn't have, like, a Macy's that they can
No Macy's, yeah.
Worked so well in Burlington.
Yeah, yeah.
It also makes me think, too, about, you know, we saw that situation that North Country had to put up with, where they had to put tents because of the asbestos problems they were having there.
Mm-hmm. PCBs.
PCBs, yeah. I'm sorry, yeah, yes. Yeah. You know, I mean, that, you know, there, it just seems like this is something that's happening more and more often now with Vermont schools.
And I think, you know, there was an assessment done of the school facilities in Vermont a couple years ago that show there's like $6 billion in deferred maintenance in all the school buildings in Vermont. A lot of them were built, you know, 50, 60, 70 years ago. And I don't think buildings are really meant to last as long as they have. And so schools are, you know, like patching things, trying to kind of, you know, keep things afloat. And it does feel like this is only going to get kind of worse until we figure out how to start putting money toward our schools.
Yeah. Well, there's another situation with education that's worrisome right now. Pete Hirschfeld, you were writing about this, where the U.S. Department of Education is saying that Vermont needs not just assistance, but needs intervention now in dealing with outcomes for students with disabilities. What is the problem here?
Well, the problem is that based on Agency of Education's most recent data, which is not actually that recent, the percentage of students with disabilities who are proficient in math and reading, in some instances across grade levels, ranges from single digits to low teens.
Not good numbers.
Not good numbers. And when we're talking about special education, this is not like a niche thing. 1 in 5 Vermont students are on individualized education plans. So, wow. So this is a huge proportion of the overall student population in Vermont. So DOE flagged those outcomes. They also flagged some issues with data and the quality of data and the way in which it was being transmitted. And, you know, I talked to some folks in the field, special education administrators, legal advocates, and they pointed the finger at AOE in large part. And they said, we've had sort of a vacuum of leadership in special education at the top at the Agency of Education over the last half decade or so. The top special education position at the agency has been vacant since January. Agency of Education said they're right. We have had some issues, leadership issues. They say they're prioritizing that they're working to resolve it. But a lot of people in the field looking for some outside help at AOE to get this right.
What's the risk here for the state of Vermont?
It's not enormous. I think worst case scenario, the federal government could withhold about $2.5 million a year from Vermont if it doesn't get these scores up over the next 3 years. In the scheme of the education budget, that's not huge. And DOE has actually never imposed financial sanctions for violations of this sort before. But I think the bigger issue is not what the penalty Vermont is going to get, but the futures of kids who are in many cases not getting the education they need to fulfill their academic and professional potential.
And is there any kind of deadline here, Pete? You said 3 years they've got to make these scores
If they are, you know, what this rating means is that the Vermont is failing to meet 60% of the standards in the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. If they can't get up above 60% for three consecutive years, then Vermont faces the prospect of financial sanctions.
Okay. Speaking of financial situations, state revenues are holding steady. Is there any good news or any clouds looming on the horizon here, Pete?
Well, a lot of lawmakers were bracing for a downgrade, right? I mean, we've had a pretty chaotic and uncertain economy for a number of years now, and I think folks are sort of waiting for the shoe to drop. We've not seen that happen yet, though. Economists say, notwithstanding all these headwinds, Vermont is on pretty strong economic footing, and that we can expect to get the state revenues that we had been expecting for the next 2 or 3 years. There are looming risks, however, and one of those, interestingly, is AI, which accounts for about 75% of stock market valuation gains since 2022. Those gains are fueling a lot of personal income tax revenue for people that are vested in the market. It's also fueling consumption taxes for people that are feeling flush and spending some of those gains. And if that AI sector is indeed a bubble, as some people fear it is, economists for the legislature and the Scott administration say Vermont could be in some real choppy waters.
Is there an over-reliance right now on AI in Vermont?
The entire economy is extraordinarily highly leveraged in AI right now, just because of the value that it represents in our economy. One economist said to me, "We're all taking this bet on AI, whether we want to be or not."
Okay, that's the scariest quote I've heard in quite some time, but thank you for giving us the update on that. Allison Novak, you wrote a really interesting story in 7 days that immediately I related to because I have seen what you were writing about here. In my own neighborhood, there are kids that ride around on e-bikes and e-motos, and I want you to explain the difference between those things.
Yeah.
What struck me about this is that, you know, it's a residential area. They're going pretty fast. A lot of these kids are not wearing helmets, and they don't look all that old to me. 10 to 12 years old here. What's going on?
Yeah, so I think e-motos and e-bikes, to some extent, have kind of exploded on the scene in Vermont in the last year. The way I got the tip for the story was in May, a crossing guard in Burlington said, you know, I'm seeing these kids, like, going to and from school on these e-bikes and e-scooters, and they aren't wearing helmets, and they're not obeying the rules of the road. Anyhow, I think there's two kind of separate problems. So there's younger kids as young as 9 and 10, riding these e-bikes and e-scooters without helmets, which, you know, I think crossing guards, schools are pretty nervous about, as well as these e-motos, which, so a e-bike has a wattage of 750 watts maximum. These e-motos can have wattage up to 6,000 or 6,500 watts of power. So they can go up to 50, 55 miles per hour. These are vehicles that, in Vermont state law, they are banned for kids under 16. You're not allowed to ride them if you're under 16 and you have to be registered with the state. But they've kind of exploded on the scene. Younger teens, 13, 14-year-olds are getting them. I met a couple 14-year-olds on the Burlington bike path riding these very powerful e-motos. There's signs now on the Burlington bike path that say no e-motos, but they didn't seem too bothered by those signs. They didn't really feel like there was going to be much repercussions for them. And I think that's part of this kind of thing that communities in South Burlington, Colchester, Burlington are struggling with, how to enforce the existing laws around these very powerful, dangerous vehicles, and, you know, also spread awareness. In South Burlington, I talked to a police sergeant who said, you know, they've been pulling kids over riding these e-motos and, you know, giving them a little education. They've gone into schools to talk to kids. And so I think that's kind of how they're handling it now, although they did say that in some cases they have issued tickets to kids who have repeatedly been riding these e-motos in unsafe ways. So it's something that, you know, the American Academy of Pediatrics has basically says that kids under 12 should not be riding e-bikes, and has a number of different kind of guidelines for parents. So I think it's really about education at this point, making sure parents understand what they're buying for their young kids.
Yeah. And I suggest folks read the article in 7 days because you explain really well the difference between these motorized vehicles for sure. Briefly, Colin Flanders, there's a Chittenden County Sheriff's Democratic primary coming up with a veteran, Dan Gamelin, facing a newcomer, Kevin Bloom. What are the issues here? What's the differences between these two candidates?
So Dan Gamelin is a career deputy, started his career shortly after becoming a police officer, joined the Chittenden County Sheriff's Department, has been there for 40 years, is a cop. Kevin Bloom is a musician, has never worked in law enforcement, does not own a gun. These two candidates could not be more different. And Kevin's campaign is interestingly based around the idea of eviction reform, which is kind of a somewhat kooky idea for a sheriff who is charged with carrying out court-ordered evictions. But in Kevin's mind, that this is the perfect place to be implementing some of these ideas. The main idea is a rental relief program that would be based around connecting people facing eviction with employers who desperately need workers. I think the big question is whether that could ever get off the ground. Kevin swears it could. And Dan Gamelin says that this position is better filled by someone who has law enforcement experience. And so it's kind of a test of how much the public wants to be using some of these public safety offices as experiments, as a way to try some of these more progressive ideas. And we'll have to see how it plays out.
You just explained to me beautifully. Now I understand what those lawn signs mean now when I see them on the street. Thank you so much for that, Colin Flanders. I just want to mention briefly that tomorrow, the USL2 championship in soccer is happening. Vermont Green FC could win back-to-back championships. They are taking on Flint City, the Flint City Bucks in Michigan tomorrow. That game will be on WCAX at 7:30 p.m. Got to leave it there. Thanks to our panel today. Peter Hirschfeld from Vermont Public, Allison Novak from 7 Days, Colin Flanders from 7 Days as well. Go Green. I'm Mitch Wertlieb. See you next week for Vermont This Week.